Last week, we studied about a man named Micah and a young priest that happened to come by his house, one that he hired to be his personal priest. Apparently, Michael came from a quite well-to-do family. He had stolen 1,100 pieces of silver from his mother. When she placed a curse on the person that had done that, well, he admitted that he was the one that had taken the money. So, things came back to a kind of a normal household, I guess. And along came this young Levite. And Micah had, prior to that, installed one of his sons as his priest, which was all out of proportion to what the law of Moses had demanded. But anyway, this young Levite came by, and he promptly hired him as personal household priest. And he set up a separate house of worship, a sanctuary, for worship along with these idols. Including at least the one that was provided for by his mother. A little later on, the Danites came by and they're searching for a land that they could live in. And they stopped off at Micah's house and they saw what was going on. And they just didn't see anything wrong with the situation there. In fact, they came back later with a whole group of Danites and stole the young priest away from Micah along with all of his idols that he had set up, and then threatened to kill him when Micah chased after him and wanted his stuff back. So this story is really about a kind of a faith gone wrong and then people who denied that it was wrong. And this story, of course, we know happened not that long after the death of Joshua, earlier on in the book of Judges. So now we're finding out in chapter 19, which is what we'll be going through tonight, we find another story, one that most of the people that the scholars that I studied about this put even earlier than Micah's story of this young Levite in the book of Judges. I'm going to read verses 1 through 9 of chapter 19, and then I'll ask some other people to read as we go along. So if you'd like to follow along, let's read verses 1 through 9. Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judea. And there was for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now on the fourth day they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. The girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. On the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning. And the girl's father, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. When the man arose to go along with the concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father said to him, "Behold, now the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey, so that you may go home." There was no king in Israel. How many times have we heard this throughout the book of Judges? There wasn't any law and order because there wasn't any central authority. Question I have is for you, and I'd appreciate your comments. Is the writer of Judges, whoever that person might be, making excuses for the lack of faith shown by Israel during these times without a king?
I don't think that he's making an excuse. I think what he's saying is that by saying this time and time again, he's saying that the people had chosen not to make God their king. That we see what is verbalized in Samuel by God to Samuel, that the Israelites are carrying that out all throughout Judges, that instead of the king, they have given up all.
I think too, yeah, thank you, Chad. That's exactly right. I think that too, that the Israelites are the ones who are making excuse for themselves rather than the writer of the book of Judges making excuse for them. Anybody else have any comments at this point? Although this Levite who was living in the hills of Ephraim sounds an awful lot like our Levite in the last story in chapter 18. It's not the same fellow. There's certainly some parallels there. But it does illustrate Micah's Levite in chapter 18 was not an isolated case at all. It apparently become common practice for the Levites to seek work wherever they could find it. This Levite who was living in northern Ephraim took a concubine. In some versions, he's referred to as a wife, perhaps a second wife. But her family was also from Bethlehem. And it seems that they had a serious falling out at one time, and the woman returned to her father's house. Some of the Bible versions that I studied reference this here as her being a prostitute. The one I just read, and I've forgotten what version that is, be offhand. New American Standard Bible refers to her as playing the harlot. They also refer to her as behaving in some unfaithful manner. Most people that I studied don't believe she actually was involved in an adulterous manner because Mosaic law would have required her execution. And then later on, we find when this man goes back to get her, he takes her gifts and is being kind to her, trying to get her to come back. Concubines, it's referred to, were actually what they would call somewhat like second wives. This was why they were sometimes referred to as wives rather than concubines. They didn't have as much privilege as the first legal wife, but they weren't slaves and they couldn't be mistreated any more than the legal wife could. And they weren't necessarily acquired for as sex slaves or mistresses. as we sometimes think of them as being. Well, 4 months now, it's been 4 months since she went back to her family. And this Levite goes back to Bethlehem to try to win her back. And this had to be quite a great relief for this father. He was joyous about seeing this Levite. I think because there was some dishonor displayed by her leaving her husband and coming back home. It was an embarrassment for her father to have her back, a married woman in his household. And so this man whined and dined him for 3 or 4 days. And then just tried to keep him there as long as he possibly could. So fifth day, this Levite took his concubine, his second wife, and he left. And it was late in the day when he decided to leave. So let's have someone who would read verses 10 through 15 for me.
I'll read them, Ron.
Okay.
But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled asses, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was far spent, and now the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeon." And he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeon or at Ramoth." So they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeon, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeon. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no man took them into his house to spend the night.
Excuse me, I didn't mute my phone there. Cute that down there. Thank you, Reverend. Okay, so this man was traveling with a servant, and I think the reason why he was doing that was probably because of the risk of traveling by himself. So he had his servant man with him, and he had a couple of extra mounts that he had available to bring his wife back from Bethlehem. But he came by Jebus, Jerusalem, which at that time had not been conquered. Judah had attempted to conquer that years before and had just not been successful. And so it was still controlled by the Jebusites at that particular time. And this Levite, with his concubine and his servant, did not want to spend any time in a foreign city. Being an Israelite, I can certainly understand that. Apparently there was some communication and trade and whatnot, peace going on with the Jebusites at this particular time. But he felt uncomfortable staying there in this city would be much more comfortable spending time in an Israelite town. So he went on until he came to Gibeah, which was a Benjamite city of Israel. And entering the gate, no one would accommodate him. And so they set up camp out in the Times Square or town square. Apparently the Benjamites were kind of low class, I guess. haughty, maybe arrogant, but they would not, nobody would offer him accommodations. And so they set up camp in the town square there. Certainly indicated the poor character of these Benjamites, that they would, it was a sign of the lack of hospitality, that normally was offered back in that era. Okay, let's read verses 16 through 21. Do we have a volunteer for that?
I can do that.
Okay, I'm going to have Sharon do it.
Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibbeth. But the men of the place were Benjamites, and he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" He said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there. And I went to Bethlehem in Judah, but I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything." The old man said, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." So he took him into his house and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank.
Normally what they would do in a city such as that is they would leave the gates open during the daytime for people moving through that into the city or out of the city for commerce. But at nighttime, when the sun went down, they would close the gates of the city for security and for safety. It mentions that this man that came in from outside was not a Benjamite, but he was from Ephraim, as the Levite was. He had a little bit more hospitality, I guess you might say, than the Benjamite, and invited this man and his group to spend the night inside of his house. He did not want them to bed down in a town square at all, I don't think because of any discomfort they might feel, but I think he knew exactly who these townspeople were, and he knew what kind of people they were. So next comes a sad story, kind of reminiscent of Sodom and Gomorrah, reminiscent of Lot living in the city of Sodom. And he, remember, he welcomed the strangers in because he was very familiar with the habits of the Sodomites. So we're going to read verses 22 through 27. I'll go ahead and do that. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door. And they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him." Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please don't act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and her concubine, and his concubine. Please let me bring them out, that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. but do not commit such an act of folly against this man, because the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning. Then he let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. These perverts were trying to break into this man's house. And he just couldn't ignore the situation. They were going to go away. They wanted the men to be sent out, not the women. And studying the hospitality of this area and that era, protecting the house guest was very critical. There wasn't any greater shame than for a host to allow something terrible to happen to a guest. They, by custom, had an obligation to protect the guests, even at the cost of their own lives and their families if necessary. So what did the old man do? He offered to send out his own virgin daughter, as well as the Levite's concubine, for them to gang rape and abuse in order to keep his male guests safe. In those days, and in many Eastern societies even today, like some fundamental sects of Islam, women are owned as property. They were considered as property. Sometimes they were even considered as of lesser value than some of the farm animals. The law of Moses was the first to value women equally with men and insist on human and humane treatment of women, giving them more rights than they had ever known in the past. Now, the Bible, as we know it, you know, still presents a man's authority over women, but in love and respect for the purpose of caring for women, not for the purpose of using them and or enslaving them. Hebrew society continued to be male-dominated, but what we see here happening to the women in this story was or never was acceptable by God. What makes this story so shocking is that these people were Israelites. They were Benjamites. They weren't Canaanites or foreigners like they and pagans like Lot ran into in the city of Sodom. So it makes it even more horrendous to find this story amongst the Israelites. Certainly homosexuality is at the center of this story, and it's still on the top of the list of godless perversions throughout the Bible, the Old Testament as well as the New. This story is shocking not only for the perversion and the brutality, but these people, parents and grandparents, were part of the Exodus. This happened early in the book of Judges. This was just one generation removed from Moses. These people knew the law. They knew about homosexuality. It was one of the main perversions, and it was cause for execution. But we find as we go through the Bible, Old Testament as well as New, that this was a commonplace occurrence. Homosexuality was just something, and you'd find a good king in the Old Testament that would run them out, then a bad king would come along, and here they are right back in business. Then sooner or later, a good king would come about and off they go again, get run back out of the country. But as soon as a weak king comes in, then they're right back in business again. going to have my wife read verses 27 through 30 again. And this will take us down to the end of the chapter.
When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up and let us go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it. Take counsel and speak up."
A few verses back down the way, we read that the old man had his virgin daughter and sent her out. The Levite sent his concubine out there as well. We know nothing more about the old man's daughter, what happened to her. But we do know that the Levite's wife, after a night of abuse, died on the doorstep. He said, "Get up, we're heading home." But she was dead. So he loaded her on a donkey and took her home. I'd like to talk about this Levite a little bit. I'd love to have your comments or your questions about him. Do you think he was an honorable man? Do you think he did what was right? Was he selfish and sacrificing his wife instead of protecting her? Was he paying back his wife for leaving him in the beginning? Did he have a cold heart? No feeling?
I didn't think a concubine was considered a wife. And as such, she would not have had the honor that the wife would have had. So I don't know if that would be why he thought he could cut her up and send her throughout the territory.
It was definitely a violation of Mosaic law for him to even be handling a dead person, let alone to do what he did to her. I don't show that. I don't see that as a sign of respect or love or anything along those lines. So I don't think that he was honorable in what he did to her. I don't know for what purpose he did it either. If he was trying to say that the men of Gibeah are bad and we need to do something about it, I think there would have been a better, more honorable way to do so than what he did.
Yeah.
Good point. What do you think, Ralph? Lenny, what do you feel about this? You have any comments?
Well, it's a sad story as far as what he did. He's protected himself as opposed to his concubine. And what he should have did was take it up with those men of the village, as opposed to just leaving and cutting up his wife. At least he would have honored her that way.
He might have talked to the elders of the village before he left. We're not told that, but we find out later that these Benjamites were not willing to prosecute the perpetrators in their own village and do anything about it. But we find out that it cost them dearly for their lack of what I want to say, their lack of being honorable and not doing something to take care of this and make it right. So later on, we're going to find out that the next couple of chapters that it is going to cost them dearly. So, you know, whether he talked to him or not and didn't get any satisfaction, we don't know, we're not told, but perhaps this might be one of the reasons why he took her home and chopped her up. You know, this was a crime, and, you know, this abuse and this, and then of course being compounded by another crime of his, you know, chopping his concubine up, sending her off, that it was mentioned hundreds and hundreds of years later. So the crime was not forgotten. The story was not forgotten. The horrendous abuse was not forgotten over the years. But it was, we almost have to cringe when we read about this story. Apparently this Levite didn't have any regard for his concubine before or after her death, sending her out rather than protecting her. I don't know, regardless of what they felt about men and, you know, women being chattel,
you know. The only thing that even comes close to this that I can think of in the Bible narrative is Saul cutting up the oxen in 1 Samuel 11 and sending those out. But when he did that, it was a warning to those that he sent it out to, something along the lines of, whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. So it was a warning to those people when Saul did that. That's the only thing that even comes close to this. I think it's what this shows us as this is absolutely just a visual aid of how sinful Israel had become, and that this was a Levite. He was a spiritual leader, and he had fallen to this degradation. And if he had fallen that far, I think that gives you an idea of how far the Israelites had gone.
Yes, and most people think that this happened fairly early on in the first generation, second generation after the death of Moses. So it was early in the time of Judges. But you're right, cutting her up was a terrible desecration that wasn't allowed by regular standards. She should have been properly buried, not hacked up to display his anger.
Ron?
Yes.
Who among us could possibly stand by and let our wife be treated that way? I would give my life before I would allow anything like that to happen to mine. Well, I can't really relate to how in the world a Levite could do that. I know the times were different, but we're still, the relationship between the husband and wife is so important that he would allow his wife to be ravished and raped all night by strangers. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. It's certainly not pleasing to the Lord.
You know, they had examples of that from Sodom and Gomorrah. They knew this story.
Right.
It had come down through the centuries, and they were well aware of the stories course, Moses was the one that wrote this, so it wasn't that long ago that the story was presented to him. But they knew God's anger at this type of thing. But they also knew that the protection of their family was utmost, even though it was a different time and a different era. It is difficult for us to understand just how somebody could allow that to happen. It's really mind-boggling. You know, these Levites, they were the butchers back in that day. They were trained on just how to dismember and cut up an animal for sacrifice, how to prepare an animal for food. So they were very skilled. And I think this Levite had the skills necessary to cut up his concubine for his own personal reasons. But this story and the story of the Levite in Micah's day who allowed himself to become a priest when he wasn't even in the proper lineage to become one, and then leave Micah and go with the Danites to become a priest for a whole tribe, paints a pretty bad picture of the Hebrew religious leaders of that particular era. This sin, as I mentioned earlier, would be remembered for a very long time. It's mentioned a couple of times in the book of Hosea, in chapter 9, verse 9, and in chapter 10, verse 9.
Ron, it occurs to me that the Levite seems to have been an honorable man. Even when we try to do the honorable things, even when we try to serve God, we have to admit that there's still going to be awful crime. And this Levite apparently did what he did, cutting up his concubine and sending her throughout Israel as a means of shocking Israel to say, look, you have to come and do something about this. You know, if you read chapter 20, the point that he's trying to make is, look at what these wicked men have done. Now, I don't excuse his behavior, and I think Ralph is right. I try to put myself in that situation. I would have gone out to them. I would not sacrifice my wife. But in many ways, he seems to have been a righteous man. And still, even though he was righteous, he encountered a crime that was perpetrated by the wicked men in the city of Gibeah. And unfortunately, I think we have to understand we're going to face the same things even today. You try to live a righteous life, you will encounter crime.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, how to take his response. You know, if you put yourself in his shoes, you know, with us today looking back on that, I think we would all know the answer, and that is that, you know, we would protect our families at all costs. So it's a little difficult to take ourselves today and put ourselves back in a situation like that 3,000 years ago and understand fully. I think you're right. I think that this this Levite was perhaps trying to show what a horrible crime it was and that it needed to go to be punished for. Pretty drastic way to shock them, and it certainly got their attention, that's for sure. Something like this had never happened before in the Israelite history. Verse 30 tells us that when these people got these pieces of his wife, they were appalled. They had never seen anything like this happen before, at least among their own people. They may have seen it, you know, in some of the pagan religions and this type of thing, but never in Israel. Right. So their thought was, what should be done about Gibeah, the homosexuals who perpetrated this terrible crime? What's to be done with these people? What about the Benjamites in general, who wouldn't bring these criminals to justice? What are we going to do about them? So apparently they had a meeting of the minds, and we'll find out what they decided in the last two chapters next week. Sounds like we have an argument going on somewhere.
Ted, I think that may be your microphone. I think everybody else's mic is muted.
It was.
Oh, Ted. I don't know. Anyway, we'll hope that you read chapters 20 and 21 next week, and we'll wind up the book of Judges. And we'll see what happens to these Benjamites and how they are taken care of. And I think that these perpetrators of this crime probably will pay the price. So anyway, anybody have any comments or questions or anything like that about chapter 19?
I did want to read, I don't know if everybody read it, but Eileen posted a chat that says, does the chopping in 12 pieces and sending her to Israel territory have anything to do with the 12 tribes? So she wanted to, I think she was asking a question and making a statement that this was definitely, there was definitely a purpose about why he did it.
Yeah, we can speculate about all kinds of reasons, but it was, as Dean said a few minutes ago, it was to shock them out of their acceptance of these things, the sinfulness that was going on. Certainly got their attention, and I think it was early enough in the time of Judges that this was a shocking circumstance, and that they were going to make things right. And I think the Benjamites were given the opportunity to make things right, but they had kind of a callous attitude towards it as well, and so they're all going to end up being punished for it. But I think you're right. It was an attention getter for all 12 tribes.
What you have to look at is the last sentence in verse 30. And it says, consider this, take counsel and speak up.
Yeah.
So he wanted to let everybody know we have to do something about it.
Yeah. So I think in some respects he was a righteous man. In other respects, he fell flat on his face. So what kind of lessons we can take from that today, kind of hard to put ourselves in shoes like that. But somebody had a comment?
Yes, it just makes no sense at all to us, the idea of offering your virgin daughter and your concubine instead of having the man be dishonored or killed. But back in that society, if the head of the house went down, the whole household might not survive. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, that they're protecting the whole family by him not going out, it may not be quite as dishonorable for him to have let that happen, because in that society, he could be costing his whole other family.
Yeah, that is a point. It they certainly had total control of their family and what happened to it. But we see the old man there that owned the house. He was willing to sacrifice his own daughter as well. They weren't looking for him. They were looking for his guests. So it's really a confusing thing. And, it is shocking to us when we really think about it today. We just can't imagine somebody doing that.
Yes. Very confusing. And didn't it happen in Jason's house, was it? Sodom. They wanted...
In Lot's house, you mean?
To carry out their dastardly deeds. But there's no justification whatsoever for offering your virgin daughter to men. Let the household fall, whatever. It's still altogether repulsive.
And it's really sad for us today, because we see this perversion going all throughout our society today. And even people looking at these stories in the Bible and saying that, that's not really something that's condemned in by God. It's acceptable. You have a lot of religious organizations today that welcome that type of behavior, welcome those type of people in through their doors, and consider it as normal behavior. We see that today all the time.
Hey, Ron?
Yeah.
Seems like we're trying to think up reasons why this person was justified in doing that, in the times. And does that happen in our days? Yes, it does. And when that happens, that person, when caught, I would hope that he is sent to prison for life, or I do believe in capital punishment. But Levi was supposedly an honorable man. To me, Levi was a coward. He didn't act like any common person should do, and Levi is not supposed to be a common person. I think he should be found guilty of murder, and I hope God takes care of that when the time comes. But that's my opinion. I find this story very disgusting, and I would not try to defend Levi and or the Levite in any way.
Yes, but it's sort of like all the rioters up in Portland. They just let them out, even if they are arrested. If there's no punishment in the city because they won't do it for some reason, they're not going to be punished in that city. So.
Well, there's, this day and age, we find all sorts of abominations going on throughout the world, throughout our country. That's just abhorrent, and yet we still make excuses, or many people at least do, make excuses, and there is no excuse. Just turn a blind eye to it and just let it go on. Say, well, you know, why make waves? You know, you're going to create problems. Just let it go and run its course. You know, God destroyed countries, country after country after country, because of these practices. And, of course, these are, you know, homosexuality and perversions like that are just a few of the godless things that people did back in those days and were punished for. But still, it's like I mentioned earlier, it is at the top of the list. And it's really, really too sad. You know, we just got to keep praying that things will improve and God will have mercy on us and we don't lose control of our country because of it. So, but this day and age, you never know what's going to happen. It just, nothing seems to surprise me anymore.
Well, I do think that we can take some comfort in this, that if we keep thinking that God is the hero, then no matter how bad the situation gets, I mean, I can't imagine sinking to this level. And it would look like wickedness is winning. Ultimately, God wins. And I think it's important for us to remember, no matter how wicked these people were, they did not stop God from carrying out his plan. And so I find some comfort in that.
Yeah, good point. Thank you. You know, we always got to remember that God is in control and he allows these things to happen, but he's going to be the one that's going to decide and make the decisions. Yes, go ahead.
My only comment is you have to read the story through to the end. You can't stop right here. The end verse tells you, again, in those days there was no king. Everyone did what was right in their eyes. That's what this whole chapter is about, because there is no king.
Yeah, it's a question I asked earlier, you know, is it because the writer is making an excuse, using that as an excuse for this wickedness going on in Israel? Or is it vice versa? So it is, you know, it's, I don't know if centralized government would be a solution. I don't think so. But perhaps it would have at least been somewhat under control back in those days. I know when, we find the same situations arising in days of the kings. You had a weak king or a bad king, or the kings in northern Israel, controlled the 10 tribes of northern Israel. I don't think we had a good one in the bunch. Allowed this type of thing to come into the country. I know at least the kings of Judah, the good ones that came along, ran those people out and kept them away from their borders. But whether a centralized kingdom would have solved the problem, I don't know. Anybody else got any comments?
Well, I was just going to say that there isn't anything that's happening today that we should be surprised over. The Bible tells us how bad it's going to get.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Carolyn. I really
it's
do.
It's just, just Satan. He's busy. He's good at his job, too. Our God is better, but he's good at his, too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And boy, we've got to be on our guard all the time, too. So
I know without ceasing.
Now, and it's not, you know, it's not a very popular position to be in when you oppose this type of behavior. I've got it in some members of my family. So, you know, so my wife and I are a little excommunicated, should we say, I don't know, because we're Christians and they're not. And they accept that type of behavior. And so we're kind of out of the loop, should I say, with the rest of some of the rest of my family. And you know, it's kind of sad, but my wife and I can handle it. We're not going to give up on our beliefs at all. And who knows, perhaps one of these days we will cause some changes in their lives. So we hope so. But somewhat of a cross to bear for our family, I guess. So